We are in Acts chapter 1, verse 6 this morning. Last week, the title of our sermon was, What About Him? And we talked about the danger of comparing our walk with Christ to somebody else's, because two walks are never going to be exactly the same, because we kind of travel different paths, we have different experiences, different crises, different problems, different experiences that are both positive and negative. So today we are moving to Acts. Now this is the Acts version of the Great Commission. I purposely did not use the Matthew account, mainly because I've done so many sermons on the Great Commission, I didn't want this to kind of slide into that. I wanted this to be different. And this has got some different information. So we are picking up in Acts chapter 1, verse 6 today. So it says, when they had come together, they were asking him, saying, Lord, is it at this time you are restoring the kingdom of Israel? And he said to them, it is not for you to know times or epochs which the Father has fixed by his own authority. All right. Now, I want you to take note of something. This is really interesting. We have now gone through 3 years of traveling with Jesus. We have now witnessed his crucifixion. They've witnessed his resurrection. He's appeared to them multiple times. And at the day he's getting ready to ascend to heaven, what's their question? Is this when you're going to start your kingdom? Is this when the restoration of Israel starts? Now, if you're Jesus, how demoralizing is that? It's like, wow, you still don't get it. Now, one of the things that's really interesting about this is the question itself. How many of you have ever had to write a test? We've got some teachers in here who've written tests. Let me tell you one of the things about writing tests that you've got to pay attention to. You have to make sure that you word the question correctly. Because if you do not ask the correct question, guess what you can't get? The right answer, right? You can't get the right answer. And by the way, I love when people come up to me and say, Stuart, I have a question. And they'll give you a hypothetical question that is intentionally given to try to force you to give an answer you don't want to give. Now, I learned this in high school. The first time I encountered this, I had a teacher, my science teacher, ask a question, and she gave us, it was a multiple choice question, but she didn't list them correctly. So there was A, B, and C. One of those was correct. But then D was, no, it was supposed to be D, which was all of the above. But then she listed E, which is none of the above. Well, that was a problem, because that can't be right. Now, you know what? I got that backwards because I gave it the way it should have been given. D was none of the above. E was all of the above. So I put A, which was wrong, and she gave me the test back. She said, that's wrong. I said, well, what's the right answer? She said, the right answer is D, all of the above. I said, that can't be right. It can't be E. It can't be all of the above. She said, what do you mean it can't be all of the above? I said, D is none of the above. E would include D. You put E as all of the above, but all of the above would include D, which is none of the above, so it can't be E. And she just looked at me and she goes, that's the stupidest thing I've ever heard. And I said, but I'm right. And she was like, you are right. So she had to give me credit for it. Now, I thought that was really funny until I became a teacher, and I remember sitting in my recliner several years ago, and I'm sitting there and I'm grading essay tests, as I'm prone to do in my recliner, and I'm sitting there grading essay tests, and I'm grousing to my wife that none of my students are getting the right answer. I said, this is a pretty good class, Stephanie. I don't understand why all these kids are missing the essay question. And my wife had the audacity to say, well, maybe you didn't phrase the question properly. Which I just want to say for the record, when she complains that students get the wrong answer on her math questions, I have never suggested that she didn't ask the question correctly. Now, here's the problem when I read the question. So I went back and I got the test and I looked and I read the question. And you know what I found out? Thanks, Scott. Scott's back there cheering for my wife. Scott's cheering for my wife. Yeah, get him, Stephanie. I read the question and she was right. I did not word it correctly. And they were... Now, here's the problem. They were answering the question that I asked, not the question I meant to ask. So the question matters, okay? The question matters. You can never get the right answer unless you ask the right question. Let me ask you a question. How many of you have ever asked God the wrong question? And the truth is, a lot of us have probably done that. We have probably been upset about something and we've asked God, and maybe we've asked God the wrong question, and so we don't get the answer that we think we're supposed to get because we're not asking the right question. These guys have been brought out to this mountain. Jesus is talking to them. He's getting ready to ascend. And what do they ask? They ask the wrong question. Is this the time you're restoring the kingdom of Israel? And what should they have asked? What should have been the question? If he's getting ready to leave, what should have been their question? What do you want us to do? What do you want us to do? What is our job? What is our mission? And that's what he's going to give them in the Great Commission. But that's not what they ask. They're still hung up on asking the same wrong question they've been asking for 3 years. Now, why do they keep asking that question? This is not hard, guys. Why do they keep asking the question? Because that's what they want to know. I tell people this all the time. When you read Genesis and you're trying to get information from Genesis that Genesis was not written to give you, guess what? You're not going to find that information. Genesis is not a book of how. Genesis is a book of who. Genesis' purpose is to tell you who created the heavens and the earth, not how he created the heavens and the earth. It's not a science book. It's not meant to be a science book. It's meant to tell us who, not how. And so when you go into Scripture and you look for specific questions that Scripture's not intended to answer, you know what people end up doing? They either get frustrated because they can't find an answer, or they make up an answer that satisfies them. And we do this with God sometimes. We look at God and we're like, in our prayer life, we're asking questions, and you can almost hear him sometimes going, it's the wrong question. You're asking me the wrong question. Stop asking me that question. How many of you have ever asked God why? Now, I bet a bunch of people in this room have asked God why. Why? Why has this happened? Why did you let that happen? Why is this going on? And it's because that's the question we want the answer to. What's the question we should be asking? In light of this happening, what do you want me to do? How am I supposed to get through this? What is your purpose for me in this? What do you want me to do? And what happens is we get frustrated because God doesn't answer the question that we ask, and that's the question we really want an answer to. I tell people all the time, the most ridiculous question in the world is asking God why. Number one, he's probably not going to tell you. Number two, if you knew why, would it change anything? Not really. And so this, we can understand the apostles here and their motivation, because there is a question that we want answers to. And it's not the right question, but we just keep asking it. How many of you ever went to your parents and asked the same question multiple times? Do you remember what happened after a certain number of those times, Steve? Yeah. Yeah. I remember more than once one of my parents squaring off on me and going, if you ask that question one more time. And that was usually, and by the way, my parents never counted to three. That whole, hey, stop doing that. Don't make me start counting. The first time I saw a parent counting to three, I was like, what are you doing? And so I'm counting so they'll know when they're supposed to stop. I said, in my house, it was as soon as they said stop. There was no countdown. There was no warning. in 3, 2, 1, I'm smacking you upside the head. There was no count. I never got a count. The warning was, we told you, stop. That was it. And so you ask the question multiple times and you think, man, if I ask this question enough, if I just keep asking this question, sooner or later he's going to get tired and give me the answer that I think I want. And yet even here, like, is this it? Is this when you're going to do this thing that we keep thinking you're supposed to do? And he said to them, I love his answer. He goes, you don't need to know that. He didn't say yes. He didn't say no. What did he tell them? That's not for you to know. That's not your business. It's not your concern. Stop asking questions that don't matter. All right? So now in verse 8, after he tells them that, he goes, you're going to receive power when the Holy Spirit has come upon you. And you shall be my witnesses both in Jerusalem and in all Judea and Samaria and even to the remotest part of the earth. These are the marching orders. Now, if you want more specifics, you can go to Matthew 28, 19 and 20, and that gives you what we call the Great Commission. Luke just kind of summarizes it here. Excuse me. He just kind of summarizes it. But I want you to notice what he says. He says, you are going to be my witnesses in Jerusalem and in Judea and Samaria and to the remotest part of the earth. Now, if you were one of the disciples, what would you be thinking at that moment? Who would be the best witness of Jesus' resurrection? Who would be the most logical, likely person to give testimony to the resurrection of Jesus? How about Jesus? Right? I mean, if you really wanted the whole world to know that you've been resurrected, wouldn't it make more sense if Jesus just started roaming around Jerusalem going, hey, how you doing? Hey, what's up? How you doing? It's like, I thought you were dead. I got better. Hadn't seen you in a while. Well, I was gone for 3 days. You know, and it's, if Jesus just walked around and told people that knew him, people that had seen him, can you imagine the look on Annas and Caiaphas' face if Jesus just rolled up in the temple one day and said, what's up, guys? But that's not what Jesus wanted to do. That wasn't the plan. He wanted these guys to be the witnesses. Now, let me ask you a question. And I don't really want to show a hands or anything. I just want you to internalize this question a little bit. How many of you have ever wondered why Jesus is not doing more to save the people in our country? Why is our country turning away from Jesus? Why isn't the church growing like it used to? What's wrong? Why isn't Jesus doing something to intervene? Now, the truth is, I've heard some of you verbalize this question before. Okay? I've heard this. I've heard it from church people, not just in this congregation, but I've heard it from church people all over the place. I see it sometimes on Facebook. People will put this in a post. It's like, you know, just don't understand why Jesus isn't doing stuff. Now, what did Jesus tell us in the Great Commission? Whose job is it? It's our job, right? It's our job. It's our job. He said, you are going to be my witnesses, both in Jerusalem and in all Judea and Samaria and to the remotest part of the earth. You are going to be my witnesses. Now, I was in a study one time, and I asked the question, how many of you believe that that statement was given directly to the disciples and only applied to the 12? You'd be amazed how many people raised their hand and said, yeah, that was a statement directly to the apostles. It has nothing to do with us. Now, I want you to think about how ridiculous that statement is. If this was only for the 12, what would have happened to the church when the 12 were all dead? The church would have died out. So obviously, that wasn't the intent. Which means this statement is for who? It's for all of you. All of us. It's for every one of us. So let me just ask you a question. What have you done to fulfill this? Besides asking God why he's not doing it. When we look around in the church and we see empty seats, we go, man, I wonder why Jesus isn't filling those seats. You know what the answer to that normally is? Because the people Jesus told to do that aren't doing a great job of it. And our solution to that is, you know what we need to do? We need to pray harder. The growth of the church, and I'll please take this the way it's intended, because I don't want anybody to run off and get on Facebook after church talking about our preacher's a heretic. That's been done before. Please don't do it. The church, the growth of the church doesn't need more prayer. It needs action. It needs action. It needs us to get out and do what needs to be done. We don't need to be asking Jesus to do it. And that's what a lot of people are like, well, I know, Lord, I pray all the time that the church would grow. You ever invite anybody to church? Nope. You ever witness? Nope. But I pray for it every day. Let me tell you something. I'll give you a little challenge. Go home today, sit down on your front porch, look at your grass, and pray for it to stop growing. Says, Lord, I don't want to mow my grass anymore. Lord, I'm lifting this up to you so my grass won't grow. And you just call and cancel the yard guy. If you have a yard guy, if you mow it yourself, just don't even go get gas. Leave the mower in the... And in 2 weeks, tell me what your yard looks like. You say, well, Stuart, I prayed for God to not make me have to mow, and my grass just kept growing. These guys are worried about the wrong thing. They're asking the wrong questions. And God says, look, here's the thing. Stop worrying about stuff that doesn't matter. I'm going to tell you as specifically as I can what I want you to do. You were witnesses of my resurrection. You were witnesses of my teaching. You're witnesses of my message. And so here's what I want you to do. And he's very specific, right? Jerusalem. What is Jerusalem to these guys? It's where they are. It's their home city. This is the epicenter of, this is where the crucifixion took place. This is where the resurrection took place. This is the epicenter. It's the capital of Israel. Start here. Then I want you to go out into the rest of Israel and the little redhead stepbrother Samaria, the Jews that we don't like, the Jews that we don't like to talk about. So I want you to evangelize Judea and then the half-Jews, the Samaritans. I want you to go evangelize them. Then once you're done with them, I want you to go out into the remotest parts of the world. I want you to take the gospel everywhere. And stop worrying about the kingdom of Israel and start worrying about the kingdom of God. Get out and do this. Be my witnesses everywhere. Okay? Now, I want you to notice verse 9 because this is really fun. And after he had said these things, he was lifted up while they were looking on, and a cloud received him out of their sight. You skip over to the next one. Thank you. Now, I want you to imagine what is going through your mind if you're one of the disciples. You're standing there, and you've just asked Jesus about the kingdom, and he's told you none of your business. Stop worrying about that. Here's what I want you to do. Here's your orders. Okay. Now, when he said that originally, what do you think all of them assumed about Jesus when he told them what their job was? Wanda, what was that, Wanda? That he's going to be right there with them. He's going to be with us. He doesn't want to be out in the front. He wants us to do it, but he's going to be around. He's going to be hanging out with us. He's going to be close by. so that we can get with him maybe once a week and meet with him and have a meal and tell him how things are going, and he can kind of update us on the plan, and we're going to have access to him, and we get to hang out and fellowship with him because he's going to be around. So can you imagine what's going through their mind when he says, okay, here's what I want you to do. Okay, got it? Y'all understand, right? Yes, sir. Good. See ya. And just poof, up in the clouds, and he's gone. How do you think they felt? Where did he go? What's he doing? Why did he leave? What? Is he coming back? If he's given us this huge task, why did he leave us? Any of you ever felt alone? Let me ask you, how many of you have ever felt overwhelmed by a task? When I was in Bible college, we had a class, Old Testament history, early Hebrew history. Our professor was Dr. Black. Dr. Black had taught my father. Ken, you had Dr. Black, didn't you? Dr. Black was one of the most intimidating people in the world. And Dr. Black, over his 40 years at Johnson, had developed what he called key questions. And he had written these out, and you actually had to buy them from the bookstore. They came in a packet. And there were, on average, about 150 questions per week that you had to answer for Old Testament history. So you would sit down and you would read the selective text, and then you would have to answer these key questions. Most of them were one-word answers, but it was really just to make sure you'd read the text. Now, I'm going to tell you the worst thing that ever happened to me as a classic procrastinator. I found out that he did not take off if you turned them in late. As long as you had them all turned in by the end of the semester, it was fine. Now, why do you suppose that is bad information for a procrastinator? Because anytime I would sit down to work on key questions, Satan would send in someone to go, hey, want to go play basketball? Or Amy would come over and say, hey, Stuart, let's go to Shoney's and get dessert. And I'm like, ooh, Amy wants to go get dessert. I'll do key questions later. We never put key questions ahead of girls. And we don't put them ahead of basketball. And we don't put them ahead of dessert, Jim. We never put them ahead of dessert. But here's the problem that I learned in my first semester with Dr. Black. When you get to week 14 of a 16-week semester, and you have papers due and finals coming up, and you sit down one night and you start riffling through the pages of key questions, and you realize 150 times 14 weeks of key questions I haven't done yet. Anybody know how many questions that is? That's a lot. Well, I'll tell you this. If it was 100 apiece, it would be 1,400 questions. 50 would be half that much, which is 700, which means I had 2,100 questions to do in 3 weeks, plus all my other work. So you know what I did? I sat down in my room and I wept. I was like, there's no way I'm going to get all this done. There's no way I'm going to get all this done. I got all these assignments and things, and I'm going to flunk these classes because my GPA at midterm was not sparkling anyway. And so I was like, I don't know what I'm going to do. And so I just felt so overwhelmed. I just sat there and I just wanted to cry. How overwhelming a job does this feel like? Hey, you 11 guys, you 11, here's what I want you to do. Save the world. Once you start in this city, and then once you're done here, it's like once we're done here, this is a massive city. Once you're done, and once you go out into Judea and Samaria, and then once you get out there and get it done, then there's the entire Roman world. Get out there, guys, and get it done. Okay. Oh, by the way, bye. And he's gone. So, I want you to notice what happens next. We're going to pick up here in verse 10. And as they were gazing intently into the sky while he was going, behold, two men in white clothing stood beside them. And they also said, "Men of Galilee, why do you stand looking into the sky? This Jesus who has been taken up from you into heaven will come in just the same way as you watched him go into heaven." He's going to come back. Notice what the angel doesn't tell him. When. He doesn't tell him when. Just says, "Hey, look, he'll be back someday." But notice the first question. Why are you standing there staring? Why are you just standing there staring? Get to work. I'll tell you what I learned that semester is that those questions didn't get done sitting there staring at the page. So what I did is I went to the convenience store. I got a two liter bottle of something we called back in the day Jolt Cola. Any of you remember Jolt Cola? Jolt Cola was energy drinks before energy drinks. I got a 2 liter of Jolt Cola and a cup and a box of pens. And I went into an empty room in the dorm and I was in there for probably 4 or 5 days. Just anytime I wasn't in class, or I was in there doing work. And you know what? I got them all done. And I swore an oath that night that I finished them that I would never do this again. And I didn't until the next semester. And that room probably should have my name on it because I spent a lot of time in that room at the end of every semester that I had Dr. Black trying to catch up on those key questions. I still have bad dreams about those key questions. But the thing is, you understand that staring at him's not going to get it done. And so they're standing there and they're looking up and they're just like, what just happened? Where is he going? What is going on? And the angel's just like, what? I think King James, "Why stand ye here gazing?" I think is what the way the King James reads that story. Why do you stand here staring? Guys, what are you doing? You've got work to do. Chop, chop, let's get going. Let's get after it. Why are you standing there looking in the sky, guys? You have work to do. Now, I want you to imagine for these guys, this is nothing like what they anticipated. When Jesus said, "Come and follow me," what were they thinking was going to happen? We're going to be on his right hand, his left hand, and he's going to be king of Israel, and we're going to be his guys. We're going to have positions of authority and power, and it's like the Knights of the Round Table, man. He's going to be the king, and we're going to be his guys. And that's what they've thought for years, even right up until the moment when Jesus is getting ready to leave. They're like, is this when the kingdom starts? Is this when we get our jobs? And he's like, "Oh yeah, I'm going to give you your job. I'm going to give you your job." So here's the question. What does that mean to you? When you hear him say, this is the job I'm leaving behind for my people. You're to be my witnesses. Where? Anywhere. Everywhere. You're to be my witnesses. Now, I want to make I want to make this morning, kind of as a closing point, a really, really important distinction that I think sadly has been lost in the church. And I use really big quotation marks when I say that, because it's an individual thing to some degree. But it's this concept of, why do I exist? What is my purpose? And you know what most Christians think their purpose is? They think their purpose is to be saved. And everything about our walk is about our own salvation. And I know that because I've heard it a million times. I don't have to do this to be saved. I don't have to do that to be saved. I don't have to come to that service to be saved. I don't have to participate in that ministry to be saved. Everything we do is framed around the statement, I don't have to do this to be saved. And that might be true. But is that your purpose? Is the final purpose of your life to be saved? Now, if the final purpose of our relationship with God was just our own salvation, guess what wouldn't exist? The Great Commission. What would Jesus have said to those guys that day on that hill before he departed if their salvation was the end goal of their relationship with him? Well done, good and faithful servants. I'm going to see the Father for a while. I'll be back for you. Kick up your feet and enjoy your salvation. And that's not what he said. He said, guys, you're to be my witnesses now. In Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, the ends of the world, your job now is to tell other people and be witnesses of me. And so for us, if we are Christians today, your relationship with God is not about your own salvation. That's already been taken care of, right? If you're saved, then that part of the thing is done. Now, what becomes your purpose? Huh? Well, save others. Can you imagine if you were drowning and you looked up on the lifeguard stand and there sat Grayson Graham? I pick on Grayson because he's a lifeguard and he's not here today to defend himself, but I'm sure Abel will tell him all about this. And Grayson's sitting on the lifeguard stand, hair flowing in the beach wind, you know, looking very much like David Hasselhoff, just a little thinner. But Grayson's sitting up there on the lifeguard stand, and you're like, oh, I know that guy. He's going to say, and you're like, Grayson, I'm drowning. Save me. And Grayson goes, oh, I'm coming. And Grayson jumps in the water and swims around a little bit and then swims to shore. And you go, whoa, what are you doing? He goes, oh, well, my first job is to save myself. That's my job, my own salvation. That's my job. Well, what about me? Well, we'll find your body. Good luck. Can you imagine if a lifeguard said that to you? That their primary function was to save themselves? For a lost world, the church is the lifeguard. We serve one function and purpose: to save the lost. And if you're sitting in the lifeguard stand this morning and you think the most important function of your relationship with God is to save yourself, you're the worst lifeguard ever. To a lost and dying world, you might be the only person equipped to help save someone else. With the specific abilities and talents you've been given, with your experiences, with the path you walked, you may be able to relate to somebody that nobody else can relate to. And can you imagine if you were perfectly created to be a witness to that person and you said, hey, not my job. I'm saved. That's where my job ends. Can you imagine that? Can you imagine if that was the attitude of the church? That, hey, our job is to save ourselves. And look, and listen, I assume most of the people in this room today are probably in a relationship with Jesus. Most of you in here are probably, and I don't like the term, but saved, we use that term. You're in a relationship with God. You've been saved, hopefully. What is terrifying is the idea that you might think that that was the end of your work, your own salvation. That's not it. Jesus says, go into all these places, Jerusalem, Judea, Samaria, the world, reach people. Do you understand what would happen to the size of the church? And when I say church, I'm being very generic here. Can you imagine what would happen to the size of the church in America if in the next 5 years, every Christian made one disciple? In 5 years, not one a month, not one a year, but in 5 years, if in the next 5 years, every Christian in America made one disciple, what would happen to the size of the church? It would double. That's crazy math, isn't it? The church would double in this country if every Christian could just make one disciple in 5 years. Now, let me ask you a question this morning. You think you're capable of that? 5 years? Some of you are going, I don't know, if I got 5 years left, well, then you better get to work. But is it reasonable to assume that in the next 5 years you could probably get one person and lead them to Christ in 5 years? Because that doesn't sound like a lot, right? That feels like a low bar. And yet that's all it would take for the church to double in the next 5 years is every Christian disciple one person. That's amazing. But you know what church statistics tell us? That's not going to happen. The church is shrinking. Now, what does that tell us? If we know how easy the math is to double the size of the church, what does it tell you that the church is shrinking in America? I'll tell you what it tells me. We're not doing our job. We're not doing our job. And all the prayer in the world, again, I'm not against prayer, but guys, if you think prayer is going to get Jesus to do your job for you, you don't understand how prayer works. That's not how it works. This morning, the praise team is going to come and lead us in our time of communion. I want to challenge you today to think about this task that we've been given, these marching orders that have been given us, and go, you know what, I want to take this seriously. I want to see if, you know, and hey, by the way, if you get more than one in the next 5 years, that'd be awesome. But, you know, can I really do this? Am I able to do this? Am I able to work with someone and develop a relationship and actually lead someone to Christ? Man, that'd be amazing. Because that is the job we've been given, to be witnesses of Christ all over the world.